If I had the money, I'd be opening this episode with the first 20 seconds of AC/DC's Back in Black, and then I'd fade that into the regular Monster Talk theme. I actually did that, and I liked it, but I really don't want to have to deal with the copyright issues in the show, so that's not actually how I'm going to start the show. So instead, I'm going to ask you to imagine that you're hearing the tick, tick, tick of the drums, and then the roaring open of Back in Black. Can you hear it? Okay, listen. And now, that'll slowly fade out, and you'll start to hear this.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long, bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome back to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm your host, Blake Smith, and today we're going to talk to authors Donald Prothero and Daniel Loxton about their long-awaited book, Abominable Science. I feel like I've watched them give birth to this amazing book, and I have to admit that this episode starts out sounding a little bit like a commercial because I'm simply blown away by the amazing work they've done. Also, I want to let you know that I'm working on a new podcast project which will be produced in tandem with Monster Talk, but will give me the opportunity to talk about some fascinating non-monster topics without stretching the parameters of this show to the breaking point. I already have a couple of episodes of that in the can, so hopefully it'll be available very soon. I'll post updates as they become available. I recently got to attend the amazing meeting, and my family and I did it as sort of a great American road trip, allowing us to hit some of the great landmarks of America, including Meteor Crater, the Grand Canyon, and of course Folk, Arkansas, the home of the legendary Boggy Creek Monster. At the amazing meeting, which was amazing, I hosted a panel about cryptozoology with Don Prothero, Daniel Loxton, and Sharon Hill. It was great to get on stage and talk about these topics I love so much with colleagues I respect so much in front of people with whom I feel such kinship. And I have to say, it's good to be back in front of the mic. I missed you folks. Now, let's get to some
Monster Talk.
On this episode of Monster Talk, we're talking to paleontologist and author Don Prothero and artist and author Daniel Loxton about their new book, which is called Abominable Science. I guess what I need for listeners who don't have a copy of this book in front of them yet, what is this book about and why do our listeners need it?
It's about monsters.
Oh, okay. Well, that's very topical.
Yeah, especially on this.
Yeah, exactly.
the subtitle is Origins of the Yeti, Nessie, and Other Famous Cryptids. Yeah, it's an attempt to get to the roots of some of these very high-profile cryptid mysteries.
I have hundreds of books on the paranormal and cryptozoological in my collection. And this is easily one of the most beautiful books I own, if it's not the most beautiful book on this topic, as well as being rich in content and well-cited and researched. It's a work of incredible scholarship and beauty, which is a rare combination.
Thank you.
So in all seriousness, I haven't seen anything like it. It's great.
It's very heavy, too.
Yeah, it is.
In many ways. We were joking at the skeptics booth that it was so heavy you could kill a Yeti two ways, with the words or hit him with it.
That's right. It is substantial. And the color prints are fantastic. It's gorgeous. How did this happen?
Well, we're really fortunate that Columbia University Press went all out on this. I mean, you think about it. There's this idea in publishing. It's been around for decades that people don't want skeptics books. It's a very old tale that skeptics have a hard time finding places to publish their research. And here we are with a big, heavy-duty academic publisher, which has produced this gorgeous hardcover with these velvety pages and color all the way through it and a dust jacket and everything, all, you know, stuff full of art, and all at an affordable price of just $30. That's really rare for an academic press, and I got to say, I'm just completely astonished. I was not expecting it to look like this, and you know, it's all thanks to Columbia.
Wow.
Yeah, they use very high quality glossy stock, which is why the weight is there. But that's necessary for all the color art that's in it. And I love the cover design, which is something they came up with, which has this appearance of some kind of an old-fashioned 1940s, 1950s type comic book or tabloid book, you know, with the Pulp Fiction, literally, with the fake tattered cover on the front. So
it's a beautiful book. Now, the contents, right? The contents are great, too. It's extremely well-researched, yet extremely readable. I think I've urged my listeners to buy a lot of different books, but if they don't buy this one, they're wrong.
You would think your listeners would want to hear it or read it, because they are predisposed to hear about monsters, and especially debunking monsters, and we're trying to do that.
Yeah, so tell me about what monsters are in this book. I mean, I know because I've got the book in my hands, but
Well, it covers the biggies, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, sea serpents, a real favorite of mine, the Yeti, the Mokele Mbembe, the sauropod dinosaur alleged to live in Africa, and with, you know, plenty of mention of other creatures along the way, but those are our big case studies.
Right? So how did you pick those?
Well, they're the most famous ones, or the most awesome.
And
the longest literature, too, yes.
Yeah.
We actually had at one time additional chapters on Chupacabra and the other lake monsters, which I wrote. And then it got so long, Columbia had to drop them out for now. So it's temporarily a shorter book than we intended. And we're hoping maybe if there's a second edition, we can put those back in, or maybe put those finished chapters on their website or something like that. Because we'd love to have covered more cryptids if we could have.
Sure. It's still about twice as long as we contracted for it.
Yeah, that's right. They were pretty tolerant about us going way over length there. So yeah.
Again, you know, just amazing support from Columbia.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing this on bookstore bookshelf. I think there's been a history, at least in my research, of my shopping, really. When I go to buy stuff at the bookstore on these topics, it's really hard to find well-researched material. And
Are you saying that research in the paranormal realm is not always that good?
We do have a phrase.
Call
we
a
say
spade
here.
A spade here, yes.
Yeah, I call it the echo chamber of paranormal literature, and it really is that. But I it's probably not just paranormal literature that has this problem, but boy, does it have the problem.
it does, but I mean, in fairness to the monster literature, I mean, this book does rest not just on the skeptical stuff, but on the, you know, and you know, on primary news sources and so on, but also on some of the better books in the monster literature, like, you know, Rupert T. Gould's Loch Ness Monster book is one of the essential sources on that topic, and you know, he thought there was a monster there.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's something else that we tried to do in this book, and especially the part that I contributed to it, was, you know, there are lots of individual books on Nessie or on Bigfoot, which are well-researched and take a skeptical viewpoint and come to conclusions very similar to what we did. But what we really wanted to do here was take the entire topic of cryptozoology as a whole and look at it from the broader perspective. How do you do the type of analysis that's appropriate in this case? Because oftentimes that's not really included, or it just sort of passed by tangentially somewhere in the final chapter of a typical book that's just analyzing, say, one cryptid like Bigfoot. So we have, as you see, the beginning chapter is more about methods and about how science works and what we can do and not do in science, and especially in the context of this kind of material, what kind of evidence there is in there and how do you rank evidence? Because as we concluded, it was the problem is largely their evidence is based on the worst possible kind, things like personal eyewitness testimony, which is useless to us scientifically, and almost never on stuff that's actually useful to us, like real hard evidence, physical remains of these things. And that's a crucial thing that changes the nature of the debate from what cryptozoologists are used to.
I want to say something about the field of cryptozoology, because it's a topic we've covered quite a bit on the show, where cryptozoology sort of borders on, sometimes it seems like it's part of biology, and sometimes it seems like it's nonsense. And some people have categorized it as pseudoscience. And where do you guys come down on that? Or do you cover that in the book?
We do. There's quite a bit in there about the kind of subculture, as well as the you know, what we think of as a field or a proto-field of cryptozoology. It's covered extensively in the last chapter of the book.
Yeah, so the last chapter has a lot of things about it, and the major thing, it follows a train of thought that we inherited from Sharon Hill in lots of ways, which is, you know, they have to pretty much play by the rules of science in a much more rigorous fashion than they have in the past, and you know, get really serious if they want to be taken seriously, get serious about excluding bad data, get serious about, you know, approaching things the scientific way, so that when something is unknown, it's not necessarily evidence of their creature, it's just evidence of the unknown, which is one of their biggest problems. Is to jump to conclusions without any evidence.
I was just going to agree that the bad apple in the data set, issue is, that's really a key one. Has there ever been anything that cryptozoologists have just plain given up on?
Good question.
Like anything ever.
Somebody sooner or later recycles it again, yes.
Yeah, and that's a problem. You know, your scholarship is not progressing if you're not able to even sort the wheat from the chaff. You know?
I am not joking when I say this. I literally, an hour ago before we started this interview, I was listening to a radio show, and there was someone on the radio essentially supporting the idea that perhaps the Cuttingley fairies were real.
But yeah.
That's only familiar from our literature anymore. Just an example of something that's been debunked over and over. Now they're going to revive that.
Yes, the girls admitted 4 of the 5 photos were fake, but the 5th one they always said was real.
Well, you know, this is like the great lesson of the skeptical literature is that nothing ever goes away. It's just, you know, it's a wheel. It just, you know, sometimes these legends will kind of pass out of the limelight for a while, but they eventually just rotate back up onto the public stage. And skeptics have a hard time keeping track of these things. You know, if it's not current, it's not in the news cycle, people get bored and you know, with turnover in the ranks of skeptical researchers, these things get forgotten. The old literature gets forgotten.
Yeah, it's a lot like whack-a-mole. Yeah.
And a lot of this book involves this kind of archaeology of our own field of digging back into insights of previous investigators that have been until now scattered across this large literature, much of it out of print and never digitized and forgotten. You
know? Well, there's a great lead into this next question I have.
Okay.
What did you learn researching the book that you think will come as a surprise to readers, even though they may already be familiar with a lot of these topics?
quite a few things. It surprises me that it's possible to make discoveries in this field. You know, there have been people talking about monsters for a long time, especially these famous ones. Like, you know, I'm sure your bookshelves look like mine, just shelf after shelf of the Loch Ness monster alone.
And, you know, and has a giant literature by itself. Yeah.
Yeah. And so how can there be anything new in that field? And yet it turns out that there's a lot of kind of basic work that's never been done. And we were able, by putting things kind of back into their historical order, you know, by dismantling this fictive history that grows up around legendary monsters and putting it back in the actual order that things come into the historical record, some insights jump out. One, in the Mokele and Bembe chapter, it's pretty clear that the Mokele and Bembe idea was born immediately after the first mountings of sauropod dinosaur skeletons in the world's museums.
Yep.
And that's surely relevant, but it's never really been discussed before in the literature, which is somewhat amazing to me.
And the irony of that story, sorry to interrupt, but the irony of that story is that what we've learned about sauropods now is that those old mounts from a century ago were grossly wrong. And they kept their tails up in the air and didn't drag them, and they never lived in swamps. And all those other myths that have accumulated about giant sauropod dinosaurs, like things that used to be called brontosaurus. And yet that is exactly what informs the legend of Mokele Bembe, is a century-old false notion of these animals, which tells you that it's cultural, not biological.
Yeah. On the topic of Bigfoot, I mean, surely the most explored cryptozoological topic there is. I was surprised during my research for my original Junior Skeptic story. I did a two-part story for the kids section of Skeptic Magazine, which is my main gig, on Bigfoot. And I was surprised to learn in there that the really key story in the Bigfoot literature, this sighting by this guy named William Rowe, which was probably the basis for the if it was a hoax, for the creature that we see in the infamous Patterson-Gimlin film. Well, because they're so similar, the William Rowe story is really the most important story in the Bigfoot literature. But I was really surprised to find out that nobody ever talked to this guy. Nobody in all of cryptozoology ever looked him in the eye, even once. And nobody was mentioning that. Nobody seemed to know that. Nobody seemed to care. And nobody had bothered to dig down and look at the roots of the story.
There were no interviews with him subsequent to his story appearing.
No, it's funny. There's apparently in history there were two versions of his story. One that appeared in the press at some point, which seems to be lost to history. I haven't been able to discover it. Nobody else has it. And the story that he told John Green by letter. And then he died, and nobody spoke to him. Now, it's not the fault of Bigfooters that William Rowe died early. That's just kind of an accident of history. But it is really important that nobody looked him in the eye, and nobody in the literature is talking about that. That's very surprising to me. And there's a lot of this stuff that is, in one after another in these mysteries, we just kept finding that. The kind of fundamental research at the root of these things had never been done.
Tell them about the King Kong connection on Nessie.
Well, this is one that had been explored somewhat in the literature, but never in depth. Rupert T. Gould, he discovered very on the George Spicer sighting, the most important Loch Ness Monster sighting, the one that gives it its long neck. That transformed it into a kind of a plesiosaur-like cryptid. Mm-hmm. Spicer had just seen King Kong. And there is a scene in the movie which is very, very similar to his sighting. Well, Gould noticed the similarity, and he asked him about it. And then it just sort of dropped out of sight. For 80 years, nobody really talked about it. Now, it's not unknown. Adrian Schein, for example, a very responsible researcher.
And great bearded Englishman.
I'm not sure he's an Englishman. He is well bearded.
He's a great bearded citizen of cryptozoology.
I can never quite keep track of all those different ways of dividing up the UK.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll just back that out and say, a man with an astonishing beard.
He does have an astonishing beard. There's just no getting around that. Well, I mean, he has mentioned in press that he thinks the Loch Ness Monster grew out of King Kong. But as far as I know, he's never developed that idea in detail. It's just something that's sort of quietly known in the background but never explored. Well, our book explores it in detail and does a direct visual comparison between the Spicer sighting sketch and these frames from King Kong that quite clearly seem to have inspired the Loch Ness Monster.
And that leads to another point, which is quite interesting, and you see this on a number of the cryptids, is that their literature is really a sort of a boom and bust cycle that reflects usually one sighting getting a lot of publicity, and then a lot of copycats, and then it dies off for a while, and then there's another sighting and a lot of publicity and a lot of copycats, and then it dies off for a while, which is a highly cultural pattern, but definitely not a biological one.
Yeah, absolutely.
And certainly Nessie shows that, where it goes through boom and bust cycles of popularity, usually right after a very highly publicized sighting. And then it's forgotten for a while, and then another sighting, and then it's all back in the literature again. But nothing to do with the biology of these animals. And, of course, the Chupacabra story, which unfortunately we could not include in this book, is classic, because Chupacabra had no existence whatsoever until it was found supposedly by a woman in Puerto Rico who had just seen the movie Species, which has a creature very much like the Chupacabra in it. And apparently she didn't quite distinguish fact from fiction. Then it spread all over Puerto Rico, and then, of course, was unknown outside that island until it was on the Christina show. And she said it was like the Oprah of the Latino world at the time. And then all of a sudden, Chupacabra was in every Latin American country in the world. remarkably, just managed to appear across an entire continent, which tells you it's a cultural artifact and not a biological one at all. And it also seems to respect the U.S. border. It only gets as far as Texas, but never much further. As soon as the Latino influence disappears, Chupacabra does too.
With Ben as the co-host, his book has been well covered here. But the transformative nature of the Chupacabra, it parallels folklore, and it is folklore. Yep. But it's interesting to me how that the media has sort of transformed hairless dogs, hairless canids, into a new Chupacabra. So, that was never part of the folklore. But as soon as people started seeing strange animals that they couldn't identify, those have become the new Chupacabra. So I would suspect most people would not recognize the Tolentino version of the Chupacabra because of all the media coverage of the hairless dogs. It's so bizarre.
And that's very cultural. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. It becomes a culturally available template that you can plug new phenomena into.
Well, how much do you think Bigfoot suffers the same sort of fate? Because all the native hairy swamp monster boogers and whatnots all across the country are getting kind of shoehorned into Bigfoot by cryptozoology enthusiasts. But like the three-toed swamp monster, that doesn't really bear that much resemblance to a Bigfoot.
It bears more resemblance than stone-skinned creatures, cannibals that can shoot lightning out of their fingers, which also gets bulldozed into the Bigfoot, the little tiny Bigfoot box, the canonical Bigfoot of modern monsterology. This is a real problem. You've got an entire continent, multiple continents of various cultures, very different people with very different stories, and all of them just getting appropriated and bulldozed into this tiny little box, which is convenient for monster enthusiasts today. It's a problem for the science of monsters if you hope that there is a signal in the noise somewhere. It's also a kind of distasteful misappropriation.
And the same occurs to Yeti. The Asian continent had a number of different kinds of strange creatures. And as Daniel was telling people at the at TAM meeting, Yeti was originally described as being a dark brown creature like the Himalayan brown bear, which probably really was based on. And yet our culture now has Yeti as a snow white creature. And almost all of its cartoon and other, stop motion in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and so on, all those versions of Yeti are now white.
Yeah. So this is more of a question for Don, but I know that a lot of people who are amateur naturalists are interested in cryptozoology. This seems so radically different from how biology works or how it seems to work. What I see a lot of is people trying to lump things into one category. But in biology, I see people looking for physical differences as being evidence for speciation. How would it be different if let's say there were extant carcasses of all these different creatures? Wouldn't they actually constitute a bunch of different species?
Now, that would be a genuinely biological way to approach it. And of course, a real biologist would have real specimens in front of them. They would have to look at samples of animals from different regions and look very closely at them for fine-scale variation and then ask the question, is it likely there are one species or more than one? And in the modern world, that's done not just with things like pelts or skins or other parts of the animal, but even their DNA can be sequenced from a reasonably large enough piece of their biology. So those things are routinely run through all sorts of genetic tests as well, where we can really decide, are these species different or not? And, of course, that's a giant difference between that and cryptozoology, which is based on legends that have no physical entities yet discovered, and therefore you can't make any real determination biologically what, if anything, they are alike or not alike. It all depends on how the legends sound in the literature. And that raises a larger question, something I try to contribute a lot to in this book as a person with a background in both geology and paleontology and also field biology. I've done a lot of field biology in my career. One of the things that really struck me, both when I was involved in things like taping Monster Quest and writing this book, was just how little any of the people who did this stuff had in the way of a notion of what we now know about field biology and field ecology. There really is a very large science now. What is the way you go about investigating things like unknown animals in regions that haven't been studied very well? And there are lots of basic principles of ecology that are well formulated now and give you predictive powers to say this or that is likely or this is unlikely. And there are, you know, ecological constraints and physiological constraints, all sorts of which things like that. And then in addition to that, you have geological factors, like in the case of all the lake monsters. They live in places that were under ice only 12,000 years ago. So all that was something we really wanted to bring into this book, this larger scale. The basic rules of modern biology and geology have got to go into this picture, and we're virtually they were occasionally mentioned casually in some of the books, but we felt that it's important to put that framework up front right at the beginning and point to it again and again, because this is really the constraining variables. This is something that seldom bothers the cryptozoologist, thinking about biological constraints or geological constraints that simply make certain things impossible.
Can I go back to your question, Blake? In biology, in taxonomy, you have your lumpers and your splitters, right? The people
right.
who that's on either side of that is very uncomfortable for cryptozoologists. The kind of basic engine of cryptozoology are sighting reports. But the problem is that witnesses do not agree at all. You know, there are not only regional variations, but there are, you know, just no end of imaginative variations of creatures that people report, right? So Bigfoot can be 20 feet tall. It can have glowing red eyes. It can be bulletproof. It can be this pattern. It can be that pattern. It can have six toes. It can have three toes, right? Now, if you bulldoze all those into a single kind of a species or a very small number, it doesn't work. Because they don't match. But if you start splitting them, that also doesn't work, because you end up very quickly with, you know, 50 or 60 different giant ape species stomping around the world undetected. Now, either way, it's a problem, you know.
Yeah, and that goes right back to our biological principles. As an ecologist myself, we know how big a home range for an animal size of Bigfoot has to be from basic biological constraints, and that doesn't fit that description at all. We know a lot about the kind of population densities they should have and how often they should be found as bones. All those things are relatively well known in the biological world, and yet none of these things are met by the sightings of Bigfoot, and which is all the more reason not to take them as seriously as they do.
So do any of the monsters that you cover get kind of a real case closed kind of a treatment?
The Loch Ness Monster is it's a bit of a door slam, I think. The Mokalium Bembe as well.
Yep.
Sea serpents are that's the chapter is much more open-ended, and you know, the habitat is just much more right. It's a more plausible creature on the face of it.
There are deep water worlds we don't know about, especially with deep water organisms, but that's a different story altogether from something like Loch Ness. So.
Yeah. There will be novelties to come out of the ocean. Yeah, we don't know what those will be.
We know. I saw the documentary Pacific Rim, so I have a pretty good idea what's coming.
Okay. Yeah.
Now remember, that's called science fiction, Blake.
Yeah. You say what you want. I'm working on my Jaeger right now.
But you know, even with the sea serpent, you know, the kind of poetry of the sea serpent really speaks to me. My parents were sea serpent witnesses, and that has really been a big influence on me and my career through my life. But you know, the chapter makes quite a strong argument for the cultural evolution of sea serpents. Again, you know, a cultural pattern rather than a biological pattern. We're not able to slam the door on sea serpents in the same way that we can on the Loch Ness Monster, but I can't give people that much comfort on the topic either.
Well, I mean, I just don't go in the water. It's not safe. That's fair enough.
Yeah.
But they're on the least of the sea serpents, actually.
Well, I mean, obviously the mermaids will get you.
They will. They're very
dangerous. Right. Yeah, I was amazed.
The great wheel of culture, mermaids are back.
Yeah, I couldn't believe when those things reemerged on cable TV just a year ago. And I thought, well, that's one that we won't have to put in the book. It's so dead. Nope, I was wrong.
Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to watch the sequel yet. Did it spend a lot of – did you guys see it?
Yeah, I saw parts. I couldn't stand it.
I'm about halfway through the sequel right now. I've just been watching it over the last couple of days.
Well, the original dealt so much with the aquatic ape hypothesis. Yeah. And
this one does too, yes.
Oh, that's a bummer. And then the woman who hypothesized that just passed away like a week ago.
Elaine Morgan, yes. Yeah. Her name was big when I was a graduate student back in the 70s, but it's pretty much laughed at by biologists today. So
yeah, I mean, I think the anybody, and I don't know, did she spend the rest of her life pushing it, or did she back away from?
Yeah, she pretty much wrote a sequel, which was some more or less the same story, restated with a few more stories built in. But I don't see her ever having moved very much far beyond it. That was her claim to fame. It got her on the bestseller list back in the 70s. Why would you abandon that?
No, that's so. I can't imagine. but
if you can milk us for the rest of your career, it'll pay your bills.
Yeah, well, you got to pay your mortgage, but I do have this sort of slavish devotion to the truth.
It's inconvenient, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, though, one thing that your book does that I haven't seen in print, and I apologize to any authors who may have covered this that I'm not aware of, but you put into print the dark underbelly of cryptozoology, in my opinion, which is that it is infested with creationists who are trying to find monsters to disprove evolution.
Yeah, this is a point that has been much neglected in literature until just recently. I mean, you've been one of the people bringing this to the attention of the public. Our book is another step along that road of revelation. But yeah, I'll let Don speak to the creationists.
Yeah, that's something, of course, that's particularly interesting to me because I battled the creationists for close to 40 years now, and what's striking about that is effectively what's happened now is that the only really active groups you'll see still looking for Kelly Mobembe or even the Loch Ness Monster are creationist groups, particularly this guy Bill Gibbons, who has no training in science whatsoever. He comes from a theological seminary, but he's a fundamentalist minister, and he's the one who shows up on Monster Quest. And when I was on Monster Quest, I didn't see it until after, of course, it was all put together and who the rest of the people were, and I didn't realize when I first viewed it who he was, but that's what he is. He's a fundamentalist minister. All I could tell when I watched the airing of the episode I was in was that he certainly didn't know anything about biology or field biology because he was doing all sorts of basic blunders and showing he had no concept of what modern field ecologist does. And that is now the big problem. That is really the only people who really are actually out there very often, so they end up on TV a lot. And they seem to think, and again, it escapes me how creationist mind actually works this way, but this is what they claim, that they supposedly are arguing that somehow we discover some animal that was thought to be extinct, and lo and behold, all of evolution will come crumbling down like a giant house of cards, which is patently ridiculous, shows they have no concept of how evolution actually works and how much evidence they would have to overturn in order to change anything. Because, we have all the time find things that are, around a long time after we thought they were extinct. But that doesn't change very much. There are things that are not too different from what's around now. So
there are probably dinosaurs in your backyard right this second.
Well, that's true. Dinosaurs aren't extinct, so we can't make sure that talk about that right there. And I have one in my the other room right now, which is hopefully not going to make noise while we're taping, because birds, of course, are dinosaurs. And that has been known now close to 40 years. But the bigger point is that this now ends up becoming almost a part of the entire creationist attempt to undermine science in this country, which is how I view it with great alarm. And I showed in my slide at TAM, one of the last images I showed was this effort in Louisiana schools now to promote Loch Ness Monster. Lo and behold, something we think is a case closed. The Loch Ness Monster to Louisiana school kids in an effort to make it part of their creation agenda, which, again, I don't see how it's going to convince anybody of creationism because it doesn't make any sense at all. But that's where they're going. I mean, literally, school kids now are being taught cryptozoology to push creationism, and that scares me.
It bothers me too because I enjoy the mysteries of cryptozoology, but I don't like to see this, I think, what can be a fun topic turned into what I think is a harmful anti-science and anti-reality approach. Yep. To mysteries. Yeah. Of the world.
Don and I have somewhat differing views, which we discussed in the last chapter, about the kind of relative potential for harm or potential for fun and awesomeness that cryptozoology has. I have a real fondness for cryptozoology because I come out of Monsters, and I'm sure a lot of your audience feels the same. You know, we love these guys. We love these monsters. We want to talk about them. So I have a hard time seeing the danger in cryptozoology, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm underestimating the harm that cryptozoology can do. But I can't help it. I'm sympathetic to it. I just have.
And I understand that. Of course, there's a big cross-border difference in our countries as well, because in the United States, 40% of the population is creationist, and we are fighting desperate battles in many states now to keep creationists from becoming very influential in the science curriculum in many public schools where they don't belong. And even when they don't officially have influence over public schools, in most parts of the country, evolution has just about vanished from the curriculum just because of the pressure of the huge number of creationists parents that any typical school class in biology will have. And for me, who's fought that battle all my life, you know, everything that I see that tends us make us less scientific and more credulous and more common to be sucked into anything that's not well supported and not bearing crucial scrutiny doesn't help the situation. Sure, the crypto creatures aren't quite as threatening as, let's say, typical creationism, but now they're linked. I have a lot more problems with cryptozoology just for that reason, that they are the in my view, sort of like a gateway drug to bad thinking.
I mean, I against that, I have to weigh my own personal experience. And again, this is, you know, it's kind of a national or regional issue somewhat. British Columbia is a very secular place. But cryptozoology for me, it was the gateway drug to the skeptical literature, to being a science writer for a living. I am in that role in my life because I dig monsters. That's how I started. And for me, it was just being an inquisitive nerd who dug monsters, dug paranormal mysteries, to being an inquisitive nerd who dug the paranormal. And nothing has changed. I'm just working with better information and digging more deeply now and later in my career. But
yeah, and that's a good thing for Daniel, but I think he's the exception to the rule from what we see.
Well, it's weird because I'm kind of skewed the same way as Daniel on this particular topic, but I don't know. I think would think, you know, we have resources like my show here.
That's right.
Yeah, and your book that can help, but it certainly is a someone has to learn that there are more in-depth studies and more helpful resources and methodologies for asking these questions than simply going, isn't that a mystery? And let's look at another one. And wasn't that an interesting, scary story?
Yeah, that's my fear. And yeah. I wonder, this book will be an acid test of this. When I published my evolution book now 6 years ago, I thought, okay, I'm going to get bomb threats and hate mail and all sorts of stuff from creationists. And it was silent as could be. The creationists simply ignored it. And not until actually it appeared in the British popular journal New Scientist did I get anybody noticing that book had been written. They are so insular and so vigilant at not ever reading anything that might shatter their point of view that they simply don't know there's any books out there that aren't creationist books. Now, my curiosity will be, and let's just see what happens. We gave Lauren Coleman a copy of this, and we're hoping that the other cryptozoologists who are prominent will actually look at it. But I'm curious to see what will happen. Will they actually look at this book and criticize it, even if it scares them and they don't like it? Or will they completely ignore it, like happens with my book on evolution, where the creationists made no effort to look at it at all? That's my real interest, is to see if we can actually make a dent on at least a few of their consciousness.
It would be nice.
To their credit, I think that cryptozoologists do tend to respond to critics. But, you know, we'll just see how that engagement plays out. You know?
Yeah, Daniel put down a really long list of things they have to meet and answers they have to provide. And my hunch will be that it's so overwhelming that most of them will simply not rise to the challenge at all. You know, they're not that interested in fighting back with any kind of real scientific rigor.
Well, I run into a lot of people who I've expressed my Bigfoot doubts to, and they say, well, how do you explain all the sightings? And instead of trying to answer that question, I usually say, Well, how do you explain all the people who see ghosts? Do you believe in ghosts? And a lot of the people who are interested in cryptozoology are not believers in ghosts. I know that sounds odd, but there's but they aren't, or a lot of them aren't. And so, you know, ghosts aren't real, but Bigfoot might be, right? And it's like, well, the point is –
Bigfoot sounds a little more like a biological
– Right, right. But the point is that the same inability of the human mind to understand exactly what it's seeing and make mistakes is true across the board for all these fields.
This is a point that I've made over at Skeptic Blog. I've called this, you know, this kind of where there's smoke, there's fire argument, an argument that should never be made again. And for exactly the same reason that you just said, Blake, I mean, you can just start making a list, you know, Bigfoot, fairies, UFOs, ghosts, levitating people. You know, you can just start going down the list. You can put hundreds of things on here. And in each case, there is this huge body of eyewitness testimony attesting to these things. And yet it's not hard to find, you know, you don't have to go far down the list before any given person will hit something that they just think is baloney. and yeah, so everyone,
the same stuff, yeah.
You know, people don't put it together, but everyone already kind of in their heart knows that the where there's smoke, there's fire argument is nonsense.
Yeah.
Where there's smoke, there's smoke. Whether there's fire is something we have to find out.
And there's another aspect to this which is interesting and that's explored extensively in our book, and that is there are different kinds of people who believe in different kinds of paranormal. And what's interesting to see, especially among the crypto community, is that there's cryptozoologists who like to cross the border, shall we say, and go into UFOlogy or something, or talk about paranormal things where Bigfoot is a shapeshifter or something like that. And then that, of course, scares the heck out of other members of the crypto community who want to be taken seriously and believe they're real scientists. And, of course, regard UFOs as unbelievable, but not Bigfoot. So we have a very strange mix of these things. And yet in the general culture, mostly you find a lot of people believe in Bigfoot also believe in UFOs.
It is.
It's based on their Bader survey, yes.
I feel for cryptozoologists on this point. On the one hand, they, you know, again, the engine of cryptozoology are eyewitness accounts. They want to be true to the accounts. They want to, you know, to collect and systematize and share the evidence that comes out of the accumulation of accounts. But a lot of the accounts have crazy stuff in them, you know, the glowing eyes and the, you know, the psychic Bigfoot and the Bigfoot that teleports and the Bigfoot that comes out of a UFO, right? Either, you know, they're damned if they do, or they're damned if they don't. Either they just pretend that stuff away, which is what a lot of cryptozoologists actually do, or they face it, in which case they're kooks. And either way, they're not able to make a, you know, to make a very credible case in the court of public opinion. Either way, guys like me and Don and you, Blake, are going to criticize them. So I do feel for them, but I, you know, it's not my problem to fix.
True.
That's their problem. Yeah, mine. Not mine either.
Well, I do. I've been seeing a lot of, I don't want to say pressure, but I see dismissive attitudes from prominent people in the skeptical community about this kind of research or this kind of work. And while I look at your book and see this incredible work of beauty and scholarship, they might see it as a waste of time. What do you say to people who say that we shouldn't be worrying about Bigfoot?
Let me take that.
Sure, you take a swing at it, Don.
Sure. I mean, there are some people whose primary interest in the skeptic community are do things that have to do with social justice and things like feminism and LGBT issues and so on. And those are all good and fine on their own, but, you know, The entire field of paranormal, and especially cryptozoology, has been a major aspect of skepticism since its early days. I would say, wouldn't you agree with me on that one, Daniel? That we've always had to deal with this, and it's been part of what a lot of people have to talk about. And it rarely gets the kind of attention that almost any one of these other issues do. And yet it does have potential for a lot of scholarship, as I think our book shows. And it is important in understanding why people believe weird things. And as I said, and I argue also, it's important understanding, you know, things like connection in cryptozoology and creationism, because it does have serious societal impacts. So it's not as trivial as just a hobby. It really does have importance in lots of ways.
Well, I brought this up on stage at the Amazing Meeting, but about 20% of the population thinks that there is a Bigfoot. And you know, most of those are not hardcore believers. There's only about 2 or 3% who are sure. But you're still talking about millions of people who are sure that there's a Bigfoot, and tens of millions of people who are pretty sure. Now, surely that is worth some kind of scholarly attention from somebody. And yet, things like Bigfoot,
the millions, yes.
You know, a few kind of specialist critics is not too big an investment for mankind to make when you've got tens of millions of people on the other side. You know, I think topics like this are worth studying. I think it's useful. If you don't, I ask, what is the point in studying anything? You know, what is the threshold that something has to meet in order to be useful enough to deserve some kind of scholarship? I think clearly monsters meet that threshold, whatever it is. And I have to, you know, going to, you know, social justice and these kinds of things, talking about skepticism in general, I always come back to the same thought, which is, you know, the largeness of your topic, you know, the thing that you live for, the cause that gets you up in the morning, the bigness of that is not diminished by the smallness of mine, you know.
Which isn't so small when you're talking 10 million people or more, right?
It's not so small, but even assume that it's just, you know, the basket weaving of scholarship. I'm not tearing down your field by pursuing mine.
We're not asking them to pursue ours either, so they can do with that time whatever they want. So, yeah.
Well, that's a great response. I would also add that, again, I think I said this on stage, but I think that in the world of cryptozoology, you see the entire world of human belief writ small. And the skills that you can learn interacting with people who believe in this topic that you may be somewhat dismissive of will carry you far in how you learn to deal with other people outside of these small issues.
Yeah, well, it's sort of like dealing with any other person who believes in paranormal.
Yeah.
But it's not quite as prickly as, let's say, a creationist or UFO.
Theoretically, creation. Right, yeah. It should not be.
The creationists, literally, their entire world is wrapped around
yep.
this church belief, and they live in an insular world like that. There are some Bigfooters maybe who fit that description, but by and large, they have normal lives outside their Bigfoot fans.
Exactly. And that's why I think it is it's a good a proving ground if you want to engage people and not just have an armchair experience of
right. That's one of the things we found was quite interesting in the last chapter. We used quite a bit on talking about who are these believers, what are their lives, because there's now a lot of demographic data about what their, you know, various categories of their beliefs are and what they believe to religion and whether they're male or female and economic and other status issues. And the larger conclusion of almost all that set of studies is they're boringly normal. They're just about like you and I from, you know, they're the average American in most respects. So they're not necessarily the less educated or even the better educated. They're not, you know, there's a couple of cases where they are sort of cornered into certain groups of, you know, certain genders and ages, but that's not the largest part of it. The largest part is that they're boringly normal, except that they believe in Bigfoot.
Yep.
You know, see, speaking to the demographics and also to having learned things during the course of this research, I was very surprised how the sex or gender demographics break down.
Yeah.
Women are at least as likely and by some data more likely to believe in cryptids than men are, which really surprised me because this is, you know, this is a topic which is famously a guy's topic, you know. But it starts to the further you get into cryptozoology, the more masculine, the more male it gets. Until, you know, when you get to the kind of elite practitioners, the people who are generating content or perhaps doing research in association with cryptozoology, they're almost exclusively men. Not completely, but overwhelmingly.
Right.
No, you take it, Don.
Well, I was going to say that one of the curious things we found is there are quite a few descriptions from several different authors of the classic Bigfoot community is largely not just male dominated, but also this sort of, you know, hunters of a different color type of thing, where their idea of tromping in the woods to experience nature instead of to hunt a deer or to go camping, it's to find Bigfoot. And so it's like their hobby. It gets them out of the house and gets them away from the family for a while, and they commune with nature, but their excuse is to go find Bigfoot. Bigfoot, and that really may not be the actual motivation. They may just want to be out in nature. And there is that sort of that male hunter, you know, female not so hunter type of stereotype running in the way the Bigfooters, especially the ones who are active in field type of things, are run.
Wow. I just noticed that if you go to conferences, it tends to be a white male thing, and there's not nearly as much
overwhelmingly
pressure. Yeah, the kind of pressures to become multicultural, all multigendered, don't seem to be there in the cryptozoology field, especially not in Bigfooting.
I think they're not under the same pressure as skeptics are that are trying to reach across society and solve social issues. They're just hobbyists who want to be there.
Yeah.
And there's nobody telling them, well, you got to have more black Bigfooters.
I wish that all the damn things I'm interested in didn't turn out to be white guy things. It's kind of sad.
a lot of things do work out that way. You know, the skeptic subculture, the atheist subculture, the geek and gamer subculture, the comic book subculture, all of these are areas where there's no particular reason to think that men are more drawn to them by nature. And yet, somehow when you get into, you know, there's maybe a subcultural problem that these things tend to wind out being disproportionately male when you get further into them.
Yeah,
it's a part of a wider conversation, which is, you know, not new to me. It's playing out across the internet right now.
I guess the important thing is, if you're looking for a date, Bigfoot conference is probably not the way to go if you're looking for somebody who's not a white guy.
Well, yeah, these guys are so conventional in many ways.
You say conventional at a convention, you see.
Oh, yeah.
Nicely done.
Cryptozoology enthusiasts, the kinds that, you know, that are far enough in to be going to conventions or generating content, they're more likely to be married, for example, than the general population. Yeah. Very, very conventional people, just regular folks who dig monsters, much like us.
Yeah,
including the beards in many cases.
Well, I used to have a beard, not anymore. So
there you go. So one last question, and then I'll let you gentlemen go. What about believers? Why should a cryptozoology enthusiast consider buying your book?
Well, it is at this point, I think that it counts as part of the sort of primary literature in some cases, with some of the arguments we've made, and it's certainly a useful collection it's very useful as a piece of dense secondary literature. So I think that is something that if you're a serious student of monsters, I think it's something that you will want to have on your bookshelf, even if it's just for the 50 or 60 pages of endnotes and citations that we include. It's the kind of thing where it would be useful to strike out from this book, even if you hate this book.
No, that's my attitude too, is that, you know, if you're a believer, you should test your belief. You should put it to the hard test and really read and really face evidence that may not give you the answer you want to hear. And if they still believe it afterwards, then more power to them. But, you know, if you're not willing to give your ideas a vigorous looking at, you're not playing it by the rules of science, that's for sure. And you're not actually being fair to yourself.
Well said.
Yeah, well said.
Yep. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for
thank you.
All this hard work. Oh my gosh! I know.
Yeah, 4 years in the making, literally.
I know. I feel like I've been a witness to the whole development. I know that even that's not true, but
but you witnessed two stages of it because we did this twice before on Monster Talk, and then last year we had no opportunity, but now we're here.
Yeah, and it's fantastic.
The long wait is over.
It's so pretty.
Thank you. It is available right now at skeptic.com, at amazon.com. The Kindle edition is out. The iTunes bookstore edition is out. The Kobo edition is out. It's out in stores.
Yeah, they said August 6th, but it actually appeared about 2 weeks earlier officially on Amazon, which is when the floodgates burst. So,
better.
Excellent. Well, gentlemen, I couldn't be prouder. I mean, it is just a wonderful thing.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to an interview with authors Donald Prothro and Daniel Loxton about their new book, Abominable Science. You can buy the new book in many places, but I would urge you to consider buying directly from Skeptic.com because a portion of the sale will support Skeptic Magazine, the folks who host Monster Talk. Monster Talk is produced with the assistance of Skeptic Magazine, but the views expressed here are those of myself and my guests and not necessarily that of the Skeptic Society or Skeptic Magazine. And while you're shopping for reading material, I'd urge you to pick up a copy of Karen Stolzno's newest book, Haunting America, which is available for the Kindle and includes details on several famous ghostly locations in the U.S. with surprising facts about the legends. Haunting America is available through Amazon.com. Thanks to everyone for their support and understanding during the show's hiatus. I do the show because I love it and the subject matter, and your support on social media, email, and in person has been wonderful and heartfelt, and I really appreciate it. Thanks to those who've contributed to our transcript project during the break. Big thanks especially to Robert Smith, Johnny Budd, Brian Cassidy, and D.R. Crane for their generous contributions. I still feel a little bit like I'm shaking off cobwebs here, but we'll get things running smoothly very quickly. For Monster Talk, I'm Blake Smith, and thank you for listening.
To stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
A lot of people who are amateur naturalists are interested in cryptozoology. Cryptozoology? Cryptozoology. That was weird.